For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
1 Kings chapter 18, the passage that we studied lo those many weeks ago, left Elijah in this really awesome place, this lofty place, literally, he's on Mount Carmel, and where God is using him to free Israel of their greatest threat, which is the onslaught of this religious system that was brought in by King Ahab's wife Jezebel, who herself was not even a Hebrew, but was rather from the north where modern-day Lebanon is, and brought down with her a whole cult called Baalism. And this was a dehumanizing, debasing cult, a fertility cult that was making sex slaves out of the men and women of Israel as they participated in the rituals around the worship of fertility. They were offering up their children to sacrifice. The whole priesthood of the worship of the one true God was being eradicated. And so God uses Elijah to effect a great victory over these prophets of Baal and really beginning to win the hearts of the people also back to God. It really is the most pivotal moment in his work. It's extraordinary. This one moment in which people see with clarity. This is where our queen and her husband are trying to take us, and we say no to that, and we're turning back to God. A huge victory. So Elijah then comes down from the mountain, as does Ahab the king, who's just witnessed the wholesale slaughter of these priests of this cult. And then Ahab did what a sniveling husband would do to a domineering queen. It says that when Ahab got home, he told Jezebel everything Elijah had done, including the way he had killed all the prophets of Baal. So, if you're Elijah and you're reading this report, you're saying to yourself, finally, victory is assured. Finally, the truth prevails. Finally, they're coming to their senses and realizing that the stranglehold spiritually that they have on the people of God has been broken. And so they will voluntarily, of course, step aside and allow the people of God to worship him in an unfettered way, and along with that, the cool things that God promises if his people would yield to him. But that's not going to be the case. And instead, what we find is this woman, Jezebel, says, send this message to Elijah. May the God strike me and even kill me if by this time tomorrow I've not killed you just as you killed them. And so here's Elijah. I wasn't expecting that. And he's sitting there and he's listening. And I'm guessing that because of the sheer shock of what's being said, there's very little that he's really picking up other than the thrice repeated word kill. And sometimes it is that way when you're just kind of blindsided by something, you're not expecting it to happen, and you just pick up the one thing. And so at this point, Elijah knows that he is in danger. Again. And the narrative that comes out of this, I want to suggest to you, is one of the most significant narratives that we'll read in the Old Testament or in the New from this perspective. And that is namely that the characters that God is working through in the Bible, in the Old Testament and the New, do not present themselves to us as these unflappable heroes who are just always doing the right thing, who are always having the right thing to say at the right time, who always stand their ground, who never have crises of faith. To the contrary, what we find is very human people that God has selected to use for his purposes that includes all of their humanity and all of the frailty that comes with that. And so we want to talk tonight about a situation in Elijah's life in response to this threat on his life that creates a sort of downward spiral in his life. He's gone from the peaks of fame and of success in turning the hearts of God's people back to him, to a place not many verses from here where he'll be crying out to God, asking that God would just take his life because it's just too much, in the pit of despair from the mountaintops of success. And in that context, there is, I think, a way for us to think about some of the inner workings of our own lives as we can find ways of connecting with Elijah to understand what is going on in my own life as I continue to seek to follow God. And maybe you've experienced some victories in your life, not maybe like Elijah at Mount Carmel, but significant things. You've taken some real territory back and you've gotten some freedom from things that you were in bondage to perhaps at an earlier time in your life. And yet we realize at that time, at the same time, that the battle's not really over. That evil is still a pervasive effect in our culture, in our world, and in our lives. And to that end, then, we find ourselves in this real place of battle between the things that God is able to do and will do and has been doing in us and through us, and the threat of a world that is far from him and that is at deep cross purposes with him. And we find that ourselves, we're kind of caught in the middle between those two agendas. And so what it says is then that Elijah hears this report about Jezebel, and it says Elijah was afraid and he ran for his life. So that brings us then to the first kind of step in a spiritual spiral downward, and that is fear, the fear factor. Now, fear is a funny thing. What do we mean by fear? What are the dynamics of fear? Fear, on the one hand, is an instinctive response to a threat. And so it's not really something you're thinking about. You're just sort of in reaction mode. And so there's like a whole TV show about the fear factor. Remember that one? There people would be thrown in a cage with snakes and stuff like that, and they would have to face their fears. It's been asked of me, because I travel a fair amount to weird places in the world, what do I fear most? And usually the conversation goes to food. And what's the scariest thing that I've been asked to eat? Maggots. I have to admit to you a recoiling effect at a shish kebab full of maggots. But apparently they are crunchy and delicious. But something about it just makes me want to run, right? And that's the way fear is. We're not thinking about it. We're just moving away from it. And in an important way, this is what Elijah's doing. He's not processing the threat from Jezebel. He's just reacting. And that is the way that fear works. That fear controls us through intimidation. It offers a power that's greater than us. And through humiliation, to point out our weaknesses. And that surely we have no strength to stand in front of this thing, whatever that is. And I want to suggest to you here this evening, bear with me. Because I want to suggest that you and I are very much like Elijah in that we also have things that compete for our heart and which we are deeply afraid of. That there are things that whether even we're aware of them or not, really haunt us. And things we don't want to look at that we are prepared to run from. That there are, in a word, deep fears that get cued in our daily life. And sometimes in a very polarizing and paralyzing sort of way. Now, I'm sitting here because I'm a fella, I'm a guy, and I know there's something true of the fellows here tonight, which is we don't talk about fear, because why? Why don't we talk about fear? Because fear is weak, right? Fear shows vulnerability, right? And no self-respectful man wants to be weak, right? Or show that he's got vulnerabilities. So I will just ask you for your abstract and intellectual participation in this discussion, knowing that in no way this relates to you. But I want to just share a few things that I think are very common and that really occupy the center of many of our fears. The faces of fear. First, fear from past trauma. That's right. That perpetual vigilance that people who have experienced trauma in combat live with is a kind of fear. And just things that set that off. Because why? Because it's hard to reconcile that kind of a life-changing experience, the fear that is associated with combat. Many of our veterans in our fellowship and certainly outside are laboring deeply with this kind of difficulty, this kind of problem. We should be moving toward our veterans with compassion and understanding. Fear of failure. Man, nobody wants to be shown to be wrong. Nobody wants to blow it. I know that I've blown it so many times that I don't even think about it that much anymore. I'm just kind of expecting it to happen. But a lot of us will find that when we fail, we just feel this deep sense of embarrassment, right? And we want to hide ourselves from any kind of scrutiny or any way that would expose the fact that we really have failed in a big way. We fear being a failure. We fear being rejected. That sometimes keeps us at great distance from other people. We don't want to be vulnerable to others because we might get burnt. We might, once they get to know us and the veneer and the facade has been broken through, they'll be like, yeah, no thanks. And we are afraid of that. We are motivated by and driven by often a fear of being exposed for the fraud and the fake that you really are. I used to have these terrible dreams long after I was finished with school that I woke up only to realize that there was that one math class that I never finished and that I don't really have the degree and that my job is a total fraud. I'm sure no one else has problems like that. The fear of death, you know, the reality is we're all going to die. And the fear of death is a deep thing. It's funny in talking to people, educated people, thoughtful people, people who are accomplished in their careers and who are well-educated often. You can talk about all kinds of things, but we can't talk about this. We can't talk about death. We can't talk about these final realities. Why? Because they don't have a settled understanding of what happens, and they're afraid. And that's why we don't talk about it, and as a result, we can't really penetrate through that fear to a place of real resolution and a place of hope. Most of the people that we're interacting with in the world today live as though this is all there is, because they don't know what's next. And that is a frightful way to live, because in the back of everyone's mind, they know I've only got a limited amount of time. And then what? I don't know. A fear of inadequacy, not good enough. A fear of the others who don't look like me, talk like me, act like me, and so forth is really a part of a pluralistic culture like our own, an increasingly difficult problem that people are facing. A fear of not having enough. And, of course, a fear of being disrespected. Some of the toughest dudes you'll ever meet are tough because inside they're so deeply insecure that they are just worried about being disrespected. All of us this evening need to be aware of the fact that we are, in many respects, driven by a deep sense of fear. There are things that we are running from, just as Elijah was. And it will be helpful for us to realize that that fear that so often drives us is at the beginning of a downward spiral that ends in a really dark place. Let's read on. Let's think through this a little bit more. The relationship of fear to faith. Here's a question. Is our fear rational? Is it rational for Elijah to be afraid of Jezebel? Well, I for one would say, yeah, that is a rational fear. It's not like fears are just like phobias that are just kind of crazy, fear of spiders or whatever. But here's a person who is a known killer and who has uttered a death threat to this man. Yes, there is definitely a basis for us to fear. But beyond that, there's a calculation involved in fear, and this is where it becomes important. Fear is a calculation that says, what am I afraid of and what am I protected by? And when we can't bring those two things together, and we can't say that the thing that we're afraid of is not as powerful as the thing that protects us, then we are driven by the fears that are within. And ultimately then, that fear leads us to a defeat. It says that he ran for his life. And so it's not wrong to have fear. We all do. We need to think through our fears and calculate whether those fears ought to be listened to or not. But once we have taken on a fear, and then we begin to act on that fear, Elijah here, where he's running for his life, now we're incurring a significant cost to our own souls, that we've obeyed the counsel of our fears, and our fear now is driving us in our lives. And that becomes deeply problematic. The narrative goes on. Elijah went to Beersheba, a town in Judea, now almost 200 miles from where he originally was. And he left his servant there, and he went alone into the wilderness, having traveled all day. He sat down under a solitary broom tree, juniper tree, thank you. I knew there was a J in there somewhere. And prayed that he would die. Take my life, for I'm no better than my ancestors who have already died. And so here we have a little bit of a clue here. He's listening to these fears. He's running from what he's afraid of. And he's traveling alone in the wilderness all day. And comes to this conclusion. He calls out to God, take my life. Why? Because I'm no better than my ancestors that have already died. So what is going on here? This is what we call spiritual depression or despondency. And the situation that he has in his soul is the product, really, to a significant extent, of having emptied himself in sacrifice. Here he had been working hard to win the hearts and minds of Israel back to the Lord. He had faced down his fears on that mountain. He had stared down the king. He had challenged the people. He had done a lot of things. And now it was just, in that sense, kind of spent. And he didn't have a whole lot left. And here, I think, is an experience that many of us have connected with in a personal way. As we have really labored to give our lives to others and to serve them, in that act of giving, we just find ourselves at points deeply empty because we've given what we've got to give. And so what begins to occur then is a heightened awareness of our failures. When we're in this depleted state, this place of despondency, it just seems like what I'm really aware of is how many faults I have and how it's almost hypocritical that I would stand up in front of anyone to tell them what's true, knowing that in my own heart, I so often violate the truth of God's word by my own attitudes, my own thinking, sometimes my own behavior. And so we just get that kind of pounding in our heads. There are times where we are deeply aware of our inadequacies and that we're not really up to the challenge that's before us. And so in that sense, Elijah is experiencing deeply dashed expectations. He thought he had won the day on Mount Carmel. It's like, come on, man. We've defeated these guys. Now it's time. And then he finds out evil doesn't go away that easily. And he's crushed by that. So now there are things that are just wearing away at his soul. He's burned out. He's hungry. He's tired. He's alone. There are two books that have really helped me understand this dynamic in a significant way. One of them is by a British writer by the name of Martin Lloyd-Jones, who wrote a book called Spiritual Depression. He was one of the most famous speakers and scholars in England of the last century. He had spent his career, he had left his medical practice in service of the Queen to become a Bible scholar, which he became, and a great teacher, which he was. And at a certain point in his life, he just realized, I am running on empty. I got nothing left to give. The weight of responsibility, the complexity of people's lives, that I'm not a match for these things. I'm in over my head. And he became deeply depressed, and out of that wrote a book called Spiritual Depression. Another book by Oswald Sanders is called A Spiritual Clinic. And in it, he has a chapter called Despondency. And this is, I think, a great passage, a great chapter, and I commend that book to all of you. It's a very short read, because he makes this great point about the temptation to fear among all of God's people. And he connects the experience of Elijah also to the experience of Moses. In Numbers chapter 15, or 11, verse 15, he says, "Please kill me, God. Do not let me see my wretchedness." Here's a guy who just had nothing left and just wanted to die because he's aware of his incredible brokenness and his incredible inadequacy. And so we read also in Jeremiah something a little darker. "Cursed be the day when I was born. Let that day not be blessed when my mother bore me. Cursed be the man who brought news of my birth to my father." It's pretty dark stuff. That's where our fears are going to take us. Into our own head, into a place where we realize that we are not up to the task, where the things that are really competing for our heart and undermining our confidence are greater than we are, and there are these moments of real despair where we just don't know what to do. And maybe it's because you're in a marriage that is deeply conflicted. And you've tried to do the right thing, to make this thing right, and it's not changing. And the weeks and months and indeed the years go by, and nothing has improved. And you're just at that despairing point. It's like, what's even the point anymore of this? I don't have what it takes. This is a failed project. Cursed be the day that I was married. Some of us have kids that we just do not understand, and or we will someday not understand them. And the complexity of the life that they face is something that's difficult for us to really comprehend. And they begin to move against us, and then we begin to feel at odds and at war in our own household with our own children. That's a thing that can happen, and it just takes the wind right out of your sails. Maybe you've tried for so long to love and care for people in your life who are far from God, and you've tried to demonstrate the love of God through patient care and the meeting of their needs and the speaking of the truth about the hope that you have within, and it's just not getting anywhere, and you see this person who you've come to love move further and further and further to the darkness of a Christless eternity, and it just weighs on your soul. I hope that you care enough to have this experience. Because I think that when we sit here and we think, well, I've got it all together, I just can't relate to despondency of any kind, I wonder, have we ever risked enough of ourselves to really be vulnerable enough to feel that kind of pain, that kind of inadequacy, to confront that level of fear within our own lives? The great men and women of the Bible are candid on this point. This is why I believe J.B. Phillips wrote a book called The Ring of Truth. And he makes this point. He says, the picture of people that we have in the Old Testament and the New are people that we can relate to. They're like us. They're not some superhumans from a different planet who never have problems and who always have the right answers. They're people locked up in the drama of living in a broken world, themselves as broken people, trying to connect with God and to experience His transformation and to experience His life flowing through us to a broken world. And in that drama and in that process, we cannot avoid all of the things that define our broken world. And in that way, Philip says, you know, the Bible brings to us the ring of truth. We can identify with these people, and which is awesome because then we can have the hope that God brings to them. And so, beginning with Elijah's fears, he runs, he finds himself alone and in this dark place, this place of deep despair, and now the narrative is going to begin to change just a little bit. It says in verse 5 that he laid down and slept under the broom tree, but as he was sleeping, an angel touched him and said, "Arise, eat." And he looked around, and there was beside his head a bread baked in hot stones and a jar of water, and so he ate and he drank and he laid down. He's getting his needs met. He's sleeping, he's resting, he's eating, he's drinking. That's kind of like step one is to take care that the depths of the problems that you're engaging, you know, are not exacerbated by just physical exhaustion. It's not an option. Years ago, I lived with a bunch of guys in a house on campus, and one of the guys in the house was really a fascinating man, and he said, "I've done a study of the great men of the world." I don't know how many he had done, but at 19, you don't ask those kind of questions. And he said, "What I've realized is they only need about 5 or 6 hours of sleep, and that their minds are just going all the time." And so he said, "Around this house, we should do that. We should go to bed at 1 and get up at 6. Well, some of us tried that for a day or two to realize, man, that's just not how it works. That's how you go insane. And the reality is we do need physical care, especially as we get a little bit older. A little bit of exercise, eating right, stuff like that, has an effect on our soul, on our mood, on our emotional life, on our ability to really think clearly, because we're not just disembodied spirits. We are a spirit in a body, and there's deep interaction between them. God is aware of this thing, and so he goes first to this need. The angel of the Lord came again, and he touched him. He said, "Arise and eat. The journey ahead will be too much for you." And so now we come to the end of the second scene of the story, and we move to the final and climactic one. God is connecting with Elijah. He's meeting that physical need, but he's calling him on to another place. And so it says in verse 8, he got up and he ate and drank, and the food gave him enough strength to travel 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. And there he spent the night in a cave. And now it says, the Lord said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah replied, "I have been zealously serving the Lord God Almighty, but the people of Israel, they have broken their covenant with you, torn down your altars, and killed every one of your prophets, and I am the only one left, and they seek my life." Okay, we've got a conversation going. That's good. This appointment with God that Elijah has in this cave on Mount Sinai begins with God just asking Elijah, in all of his despondency and his despair and his fear and his anger and all of those things that constitute the sum of his soul at this point, he just asks him, "What are you doing here?" It's not a question that God is unaware of the answer. He's not asking that kind of question. He's asking a question so that Elijah would begin thinking through, you know, what is it that has brought me to this place? Why am I here? What happened? I was on the mountain over here and all these things, and now I'm in a different mountain, and I'm losing it. I'm falling apart. What happened? He complains to the Lord. I've been zealously serving the Lord God Almighty. The people of Israel have broken their covenant. So he's just honest with God. And he says, I got a complaint. I'm zealous and everyone around me sucks. That's basically what he's saying, right? All of Israel is doing their thing and I'm the one, you know, who has been zealous for you. And what's going on here? Under the surface is not a complaint. It's an accusation, isn't it? What is he really saying here? He's saying, God, you put me in an utterly untenable, no-win situation. This is a fool's errand. Why would I ever be sent out to do this thing? No person could ever accomplish that. It's the impossible. And then the second complaint, I am the only one left and they seek my life too. So this complaint basically is the I alone claim. You've put me in an impossible burden on my back. And so this is where Elijah, in his honesty, is standing before God. What we find at the end of the day is below the surface of a lot of our fear and the things that come with it, the damage to our soul that listening to the counsel of our fears produces, is a complaint that we have against God himself. Remember in the Garden of Eden, when God asked that first rhetorical question to Adam. Adam, he says, where are you? Remember that? Adam and Eve had taken from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, a tree that God said, don't do that. On the day that you do that, you shall surely die. And now death is taking root. And when they hear God moving toward them, they hide in the bushes, they hide with the fig leaves and all this kind of crazy stuff. And God says, where are you? What happened to you? What have you become? And Adam's response was, well, actually, it's the woman's fault. She's the one who shared this beautiful fruit with me, and I was just beguiled by her beauty and so forth. To the woman, she says, well, it's the serpent over here that you placed in the garden that's really the cause of it. And everyone's pointing fingers around them, but ultimately it goes to God. It's the things that you've given that are the source of my problems. And there is a beef with God deep in the heart of people who are listening to the counsel of their fears. Because they are saying, in essence, God is not enough. And we're questioning, is God good enough as well? And this is really where Elijah is. And so, God says, okay, I'll take your complaints and suggest you do this. Go out and stand before me on the mountain. And as Elijah stood there, the Lord passed by, and a mighty windstorm hit the mountain. It was such a terrible blast that the rocks were torn loose. But the Lord, it says, was not in the wind. Earth shattering. It's a freaky thing to feel the ground under you shift and move. We were down in Ecuador a couple weeks ago, and there was a earthquake. I had never been in one before. I don't know if you've ever been in an earthquake before. The building we're in just went, like, whoa. And then the next day, we were sitting outside on this really heavy gravel path. And again, it happened. We're going like this. We're like, that's not supposed to happen, I don't think. You know? The power of an earthquake is incredible. It's those shifting of place that created the Andes Mountains to begin with. But God, it says, was not in the earthquake, was not in the blast of air. And after the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, there was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire was the sound of a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak, and he went out and he stood at the entrance of the cave. And so this is really a sweet and well-celebrated story here. It's about hearing the voice of God. And it seems first that Elijah, for the longest time, was just not in a place where he was prepared to hear the voice of God. He could not listen. And I'm reminded of a story by the Chinese writer Watchman Nee, who talks about this passage and talks about the dynamic within it. And he talks about the fact that he was walking down the seashore one day with a good friend of his, and there was out in the water a man who was flailing in the water and was in the process of drowning. The friend that Nee was with was a good swimmer, and they stopped in their tracks and they were looking at this man flailing about in the water. And Nee at this time is becoming nervous. He says, "Look, you're a great swimmer. You go out and save this man." And he just stood there. Nope, wasn't going to do it. The man goes down, bobbles back up again, flailing about. At this point, Nee is like, "Come on, man. Really, this guy's life is in danger. Go!" Still no movement. Just going to stay right there. Finally, a third time, the man goes under the water. And now, after the third bob of the guy, into the water goes Nee's friend. And he brings him back to the shore and makes sure he's okay. And Nee at this point is furious. He says, "What is wrong with you?" This man was experiencing the terror of death. He was dying out there. You could have intervened way earlier than you did, and how sadistic is that? And his friend said, "Well, you don't understand. See, he was not done flailing. And had I gone out earlier, he would have taken me down with him. He was not at a place to be rescued." And in a real similar sense, Elijah is in that place as well. God is not in the tumultuous events of the earthquake and the wind and all of those things. It took time for Elijah to get that relaxed feel, to come to an end of himself, and to reach out and hear something that is a gentle voice and not a blaring horn. And so we want to find a solution that to our problems that are experiential and that are immediate, right? I had a friend many years ago in the late 80s who was diagnosed with HIV/AIDS. And at that stage of the game, there was no treatment that was going to work. And this young 28-year-old was going to die. And I remember as his life unfolded, that he just went to every place that he could. He went to Brazil. He went to a Pentecostal church. He went to all manner of places because he just had to have the experience of being loved and cared for by God. He was so deeply consumed by his own shame, his own guilt, and his own fear of death. He needed something that would rattle his world, he thought. And he went to those places and nothing. And in his despair, in the last weeks of his life, Michael began to just listen to the Lord and to call out to him in his despair and to listen. And before he died, he did develop this deep sense of peace and calm, a sense of the love of God that transcends knowledge, a closeness to him that he could not conjure up through experience. And I've always looked at that experience as an important lesson for me and for everyone I tell it to. Which is that it's really only when we're at that very broken place and we're done fighting, we're done justifying ourselves, we're done accusing God, and we're just turning to Him in our utter brokenness to say, please, I ask for your mercy. Now we're in a place where we can hear. Now we can hear. Are you here tonight at that place in your own life where you've been fighting and accusing and self-justifying and doing everything that you can to be the master of your own little universe, and you feel the weight of it collapsing in upon you, and you just don't know, what do I do? And we can learn from this right here. In the quiet of your own heart, if you just turn to God and say, Lord, be merciful to me. I'm a sinful person. I'm just asking for your grace. I'm asking that what you did on the cross through Jesus Christ, the death that he died for all of human faults, sin, that would be accredited to my account. I'm done fighting. I'm done with all the self-justifying. I just know that all I really want is a gift from you. I just want to be forgiven. I want to be restored. And that's where it all begins to happen. That's where change occurs, at that humble place where we're just reaching out to God in that innocent sort of way. Boy, is it hard to get to that place in an ongoing way in our life. The art of listening in a world of distraction is hard to cultivate, isn't it? It is. And so, you know, I don't know about you, but I'll sit in my office and I'm reading my Bible and I'm developing some insights, and blink, my email comes on. And like a squirrel, I'm, you know, moving this way and moving that way and moving the other way. And then I've lost the insight, lost the moment. And it's really, I think, super important for us if we're going to have real spiritual, a robust spiritual life in a world of distraction like our own, to find those quiet moments in a consistent way where we can seek the Lord out through His Word and in prayer and listen. Listen to that still, small voice as He speaks to our thinking, as He puts new burdens on our heart and thinking in our head in conformity with His Word. And we have that definite sense that I've been spoken to by God. That's the kind of thing that on a regular basis God seeks for us. If we're at that place, then we can hear the voice of God. And he goes on to again repeat to Elijah, he says, what are you doing here? Second time. And a second time, Elijah says the exact same thing. Well, I've been really zealously serving the Lord Almighty, but the people of Israel have broken their covenant with you, torn down your altars, killed every one of your prophets. I'm the only one who's left. They seek to take my life too. And the Lord said, okay, now that we're communicating, now that you're hearing me, go back the same way you came. Travel to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, anoint Hazael to be king of Aram, and Jehu, the king of Israel, and anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from the town of Abdol-Moleh, to replace you as prophet. That's what God has to say to him. Then he goes on. Anyone who escapes from Hazael will be killed by Jehu, and those who escape Jehu will be killed by Elisha. Yet I will preserve 7,000 others in Israel who have never bowed down to Baal or kissed his image. So now we're getting down to it. This is what God says to the despondent Elijah. Three things. One, he addresses his fears. And he says, look, you're called to action. Go back the same way you came. You know what? Fear is something that you can never think your way out of. You just have to take action against the counsel of your fears. He says, go back the same way that you came and anoint the Aramean and Judean kings. And that's important because what's going to happen then is those kings are going to conspire against Ahab and his wife Jezebel, and they're going to be the ones that will rid Israel of this plague. So Elijah is called to trust God with the mission and experience the confirmation of this later. It's not a fool's errand that Elijah was ever on. It's just that he only got a picture of the thing, a part of the picture of what he was called to do without an understanding of that God was involved with other people that he was raising up to engage this terrible problem. When we listen to the counsel of our fears, we are paralyzed. We move to isolation and we just wither. When we are facing our fears, as Elijah is called to by God, it means go back to what you are afraid of and do the things that God calls us to enable us to begin to then see that God is in fact at work. Second, there's the correcting of Elijah's vision, the things that he was not himself seeing. The reality is he's never been alone. And it's never been all up to him. Three times in the narrative, in chapter 18 and 19, the narrator makes it clear that there are all kinds of hundreds of people who have not bowed to Baal and this false cult. 7,000 of them remain until now. He was never alone, and God is like saying, you know what? We need to look at what you're really afraid of here. You're living under this weight of fear, and you're running, and you're trying to do these things in your life to avoid shame, to prop up your reputation, to make you feel okay about yourself or whatever, and none of those things are going to suffice. None of them are adequate. And we need to just call it what it is and be honest. Wonder if there is a connection between despondency and pride. How many of us are walking on the melancholy end of the spectrum and know all about the darkness of despair? Oh, come on, man. I'm not the only one, really? Two. Good. Three. Four. Five, six. And the rest of you are liars. Okay. What we realize at a certain point is that persisting on in the darkness that overcomes has a certain amount of pride associated with it. It keeps us distant from other people and unaccountable to them. It makes us feel, in the language of AA, terminally unique. I'm just so different than everyone else, and no one can really understand me or get me in some way. And therefore, I'm justified in staying in my cesspool of misery because no one's really qualified to rescue me. What is that? That's BS. That's what that is. That's a lie. That's pride. That's all that is. Admit it. You're prideful. And that your pride is at the basis of a lot of the dysfunction that you're feeling within. Further, there's a subtle rebuke in this because if it's true that Elijah is all alone and he wants to die, why would you want to die if you're God's only voice? Think about that, how selfish that is, right? You think about that? Yeah. And lastly, that Elijah is connected to a whole network of relationships, the so-called school of the prophets, which we'll read about starting next week and in the weeks ahead. Lastly, there's the blessing of partnership that God grants to Elijah in this point of despair. Namely, that Elijah and Elisha form intimate bonds of friendship from this point on. And the rest of the story of 1 Kings and through the second chapter of 2 Kings is about what God is doing in them and through them on behalf of Israel. And it's a sweet story, a deep bond that they form with one another. We're going to begin talking about that next week. So just to recap very briefly, despondency is something that is sort of the birthright of a person who cares about the things that God cares about in a broken world that does not care about those things. It shouldn't surprise us or shock us that there are fears that emanate within us that cause us to run. And if we are mindful that we're on the run, then it enables us to see the fact that when we are finding those places of isolation, that deep despairing even of life, that cynicism that so pervades our culture that says nothing matters, to hell with it all, who cares anyway? that ultimately, at the end of the day, we're realizing the real problem that I'm having is not a problem with me in relation to the world. It's a problem I'm having in me in relation to God. Is God good? Is God adequate? Those are the two questions that we have to have deep, resonating answers to in our own heart. Because in having those answers, it enables us to face our fears. It enables us to listen to God's corrective voice. And it moves us not in isolation from others, but closer and more deeply rooted to one another. So that, my friends, is the lesson of Elijah in the wilderness.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.